This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. Today, I would like to welcome Dr. Rodney Knight, Assistant Professor at the UBC Faculty of Medicine.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Nice to have you on the show. So, Gurman, do you want to start us off with a few questions for Dr. Knight, please?
Yeah, so could you just start by telling us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine in the Division of Social Medicine at UBC. And I lead a program of research that focuses on the mental health, on substance use related needs, and sexual health of young people.
Great. Yeah, so I noticed you're also a part of the focus research team studying the COVID-19 pandemic. From what I understand, you're examining on how public health measures such as social distancing affect like the longer term social and health of youth under 30. Could you maybe tell us a bit more about the study and what you're doing?
Yeah, so this is a study that was funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research during a call they put out in the earlier days of COVID-19. So I think this announcement came out in May. And it was really a rapid way for the government to get money into the universities for researchers to better understand what's happening with COVID-19. And it was what's called an open call, so we could really come up with an investigator-led research question. And so given that my team is very focused on the social and health outcomes of young people, it was really a natural fit for us to ask some questions about how are the public health directives, so mainly those that are really requiring folks to either quarantine, self-isolate, or just experience isolation due to physical distancing measures, how is that affecting young people's lives broadly? And so we're very much interested, and I know this is why you invited me here, in mental health outcomes of young people during COVID-19 related public health measures. And so this study is actually taking part in both Canada and France. So I have a team of counterparts who are also based out of Paris, and then a team based here in Vancouver and Montreal. And we're trying to really identify what are the factors of public, or what are the features of different public health directives that are affecting young people's social and health-related outcomes. And so our hope is to really do some comparative work, both with, you know, doing comparisons across Canada, but also across or between the two countries, so Canada and France.
Yeah, it seems like an interesting country, France. Is there a reason why you chose to collaborate with that country and what was going on there?
Yeah, so I remember in the spring, the early spring, seeing what was happening and occurring in France, where their COVID-19 curve was quite a bit more severe than ours. We nevertheless, in Canada, tended to be able to look to France and see what was occurring. And many of the things that were occurring happened to us subsequently. So I for me, it was this interesting notion of what, like to ask as a scientist, what can we learn from France as they've, you know, they were hit really hard at the beginning by the curve and implemented really tough quarantine measures. So even before I wrote this grant and was successful in getting it, I had a lot of questions around what can public health learn from these countries like France, like Italy, where COVID-19 really hit them hard. What are the lessons learned? And also, how can we be preparing for some of the public health measures that almost seemed at that time inevitable, and many of the public health measures we've seen implemented in countries like France ended up being implemented here. So a really good example is mandated wearing of masks. That had occurred in France long before that ended up being implemented here. And that's just one example. Yeah, there was really something around both the scientific dimension here of you know, what can we learn by doing these international comparative projects, but also, I mean, to be perfectly honest, there was a bit of, it was really a low-hanging fruit for me because I have existing and long-standing collaborations in France. I actually did my postdoctorate work there, and so I was able to just pick up a, well, it was a Zoom call, chat with a colleague at the Paris University, see if she was interested in collaborating, and she was, and we were off to the races.
That's great to hear. And how long has basically this study been running for, and when do you think it's going to conclude in terms of like data collection?
Yeah, so it's a 1 year study. So it's 1 year of funding. In terms of the data that we are collecting, we have, so it's a mixed method study. So that means we're using both quantitative, we're combining actually, quantitative and qualitative approaches. We're currently collecting data using both approaches. We're in terms of the quantitative, we're conducting an online survey across both countries. And we're just about finished. We've just about recruited 5,000 young people, so 2,500 in each country. And we've started conducting some preliminary analyses of those data. Concurrently, we're also doing some qualitative work, as I mentioned. So we're conducting interviews with comparatively a very small subset of young people. And we're focusing just within Vancouver and Montreal, where we're talking to young people about their experiences. And the things that we'll talk about in those interviews, much of that will be informed by what we're learning from the quantitative data. And this is really a hallmark of this kind of mixed methods approach to study. So, and I'm sure we'll get into this in more detail, but we are seeing some pretty significant mental health related self-reported outcomes. And so we want to better understand two things. One, why, what are the factors associated with you know, the negative outcomes, as well as for those who might be somewhat, you know, not being experiencing the negative outcomes. And two, and perhaps just as importantly, to identify what can be done to help address or mitigate the kind of negative outcomes we're seeing.
Now, Gurman, you mentioned to me before that you completed the survey that was on the website. That's right?
Yeah.
So what were your thoughts on that in general?
Yeah, I thought it was very extensive. Like there were quite a few extensive questions on a variety of different subjects that I did not expect. One question that stemmed while I was doing the survey, was there any like particular target group you're aiming for? Because I noticed there were lots of questions in particular on substance use, sexual health, financial strain. Or was this really more aimed at just the average person between 18 and 30?
So our aim is very much to get a spread of young people from across different demographics. So, you know, everything from getting diverse sexual and gender representations to diverse experiences with substance use, very much focused on trying to recruit racially diverse people, people of all different socioeconomic status. And this is really the reason with a survey like this that we would want diversity within the sample is so we can start to understand how, you know, some experiences of, for instance, occupying a specific social position might either confer benefits or disadvantages in terms of the outcomes we're looking at, or might be associated. So one example is generally in population mental health studies, we know, for example, LGBTQ young people almost invariably tend to experience worse health outcomes, mental health outcomes than their cisgender and heterosexual counterparts. And those are the reason we want to understand, you know, the differential effects in terms of these outcomes is so we can identify when inequities are occurring, so as to inform ultimately interventions that might need to be either targeted or universal in nature.
Great, thanks for sharing that with us. We'll be right back on Research Review after just a few messages.
Redcap Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcap.ca for more information.
We are back here on Research Review. I am your host, Alirod, joined with my co-host, Gurman Gill. And today we are interviewing Dr. Rodney Knight. So, Gurman, please carry on. You had a question to ask.
Do you think that people who are struggling with mental health conditions before the pandemic were able to learn coping strategies that helped them during the pandemic? Or was it more just that they were still worse off than people who are starting to deal with this for the first time, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So I only have a hypothesis, and I haven't seen good data on this yet. Unfortunately, my hypothesis is that we will see those who already had mental health problems or a mental health disorder will experience, for instance, experiences of isolation due to COVID-19 public health directives in ways that will likely inequitably burden those groups. So they likely will experience even worse outcomes. And so that's highly concerning. I haven't seen the data necessarily, like I haven't seen that data in analyses we've run yet to see, you know, around pre-existing mental health issues and how that is playing out. But, you know, that's a really important piece that work remains to be done. And so, I mean, for me, it's a priority population, people who have pre-existing mental health conditions during this time really need, you know, even more help.
Yeah, definitely. Could you walk us through some of the preliminary data that you have so far?
Yeah, so I do have some. So let's just take a look here. So, you know, maybe before I jump into a little bit of the data, what I think is interesting here, I pulled some numbers on, I did an interview the other day as well with a radio show in Victoria, and they were really interested in talking about how there's some blame being focused specifically on young adults as the spreaders or vectors of disease spread. And so I was really interested in better understanding, like, so what proportion of COVID cases are in terms of acquisition, so becoming reporting positive, are young people experiencing versus what proportion of the population do they represent? And so in Canada, young people ages 20 to 29 years are 18, they represent 18, roughly about 18.7% of COVID-19 cases, while making up 13.5% of the population. And the numbers are comparable here in BC, so they're just off by a couple percent. And I think this is interesting. So it's slightly higher COVID-19 cases for the proportion of the population they represent. And in some ways, we, you know, if you start wondering or problematizing or interrogating why this might be occurring, it makes, you know, we can start to understand why if we start throwing the ingredients into how an exposure could occur. So we know young people are the ones who are most likely to be working frontline jobs, for example. So they're out in the community. They're in the community where those, especially the community transmission, is occurring. So that to me is it's not a hugely difference. Like, it's not this huge marked difference that we sometimes might assume is occurring when we look at the public discourse around, you know, well, I'm sure we all remember back in the early days of COVID-19, the pictures of young people partying on the beaches in Florida. And there's been similar kinds of pictures that tend to go across social media of depicting young people as being irresponsible. So one of the things that I first wanted to see in our data set as the data was coming in is how do rates of adherence or compliance to public health measures, how are they occurring? So these are German, you'll know as you conducted or you participated in the survey, we ask for self-reports of how one is adhering to the directives in their area. And what we see is, in fact, the vast majority are adhering regularly to physical distancing, to wearing masks, to hygiene practices like washing hands. So over 88% report regular adherence. And less than 1% report not adhering at all. So it's a very small percentage of this group. And the numbers, in fact, are not that different in France. So those kinds of numbers are very, very, and I think that these, you know, directly contradict some of those popular depictions we're seeing of young people as being inherently irresponsible. You know, this shows me most always are reporting they're always adhering to the guidelines. And then, you know, the remainder usually are. A very small fraction reporting they're not at all. I wonder how that relates. I haven't seen the data yet. I wonder how that relates to other age groups. It'd be an interesting piece to look into.
Yeah, I was actually a bit surprised by that. I kind of assumed that with the media going around saying that the young people are sort of the super spreaders, I sort of had this idea in mind that we were the vast majority of the people not adhering to these guidelines. And it gets spread around pretty quickly, especially in like the UBC community. There's like videos of frat parties going on and just not adhering to social distancing at all. And I think that sort of like clumps everyone up into a group where they just assume everyone is a super spreader. And I sort of started to believe that myself as well. I just like looked at every young person and just blamed them for the reason this is going on. Which is why I was curious about another set of questions that were asked in the survey where you asked basically, how do young people feel about their depiction in the media?
Yeah. And so that is a piece, I wonder if I have the number in front of me. I was just looking at it this afternoon. Certainly from my preliminary look at these data, young people are highly aware of those depictions. And then we have a question, if you'll recall, of do they agree? And surprisingly, a lot of them, like you, it sounds like, did agree with those depictions. So that's an interesting piece. So they're agreeing, you know, it's one of those pieces where most are adhering, you know, that we talk to here in this sample. But most also think that young people don't adhere. So I think there are implications we're going to have to think through around how some of this messaging has occurred around young people as being inherently irresponsible, particularly with regards to how stigmatization of young people's behavior can really impact their life and what they do and what they can do. You know, I've studied stigma in other areas for over a decade. So for instance, in the area of HIV, in the area of substance use, and we know very well stigma is one of those really nasty problems in which it can just really present massive barriers to care, barriers to being able to talk about how one's feeling, about the health or social needs they have. And so I don't know how that's going to play out, but I do, for me, I actively want to push back against these public depictions of young people as being irresponsible. I don't see that playing out. You know, we see it anecdotally. There's no doubt about that. There are instances in which, you know, people are having parties, for example. But at the population level, the data are not bearing out that young people are not taking this virus seriously and the public health directive seriously. So I have some findings around mental health as well. They're very preliminary. And I saw today my colleagues actually at UBC Nursing and UBC School of Population Public Health also just published something today in the Journal of, is it the Journal of Psychiatry? And this is really, you know, their analysis, it's more sophisticated than what I'm going to present, but they really found that the more you're exposed to like a quarantine or a lockdown, the more likely you are to experience thoughts of suicide. What we have found with this survey, with the focus survey here in Canada, well, let me preface before with some, so we used to measure self-reported mental health. We used a measure that we took out of the, or that we used from, it's a measure that the Canadian Community Health Survey, CCHS, uses to measure self-reported or self-perceptions about mental health. And it can be rated as poor, fair, good, and excellent, I think. I think there's four. But what's important here is from 2011 to 2018, we saw around generally 5 to 15% of young people reporting fair or poor. So the negative side of this. So 5 to 15%. And it was going up over that decade, that just under a decade. We asked the same questions in this survey, and we are seeing 66% reporting poor or fair. So this, you know, this is concerning that, you know, folks are experiencing distress. And I also have another survey that's not focus survey, but this was a survey that, it's called Heads Together, and we ended up launching it just as COVID occurred. So we did quickly adapt it to ask some questions about COVID. And this is a survey that included about 500 LGBTQ people from across Canada. And I'm just going to pull up this slide so I can give you the numbers. So we were asking about questions around, so this is a quick content warning for those of you who are listening. I'm just going to give some measures around suicide and suicide ideation. So we asked in this survey that was conducted in June and July about how people had considered suicide ideation, the reports of suicide ideation over the last 12 months, and it was high. So it was 45% reported in the last 12 months they had some suicide ideation. Now what's concerning is of that 45%, in the last month. So they reported 59% reported that they had suicide ideation just in the last month alone. So during some of these pretty severe lockdown measures that we had. It gets even more worrisome. We also asked around suicide attempts. So in the last 12 months, 6% of respondents indicated they had attempted suicide. And then when we asked in the last month, 38% indicated they had attempted suicide. Like, these numbers are extremely concerning. They are very, very, very high. We haven't done in-depth analyses around suicide-related measures within the FOCUS survey, so this broader survey across Canada and France. But given some of these, these preliminary numbers we have around mental health as being poor generally, we have concerns. We have concerns.
Great. Thanks for sharing that with us. We'll be right back on Research Review after just a few messages.
This music, reggae music, is tell the whole world, you know, telepathically and physically and mentally and spiritually, we are telling them to this music, yeah.
So you heard it here at Rocker Show 101.9 FM CITR, featuring yours truly, George Beard, keeping the reggae music alive on the west coast of Canada. It's all about roots rock, lovers rock, dancehall, reggae music. On CITR Rocker Show, Sunday noon to 3 p.m. each and every Sunday. Love of Jack. For over 25 years of doing it nice, warm, and easy. Until next time, such time, keep the faith and spread it gently. Jah bless and Jah guidance. Jah out.
I'm looking at me.
Bless out.
Don't mind on the rhythm and on wine in a ace. Got a motion in a rubber, don't bless.
And we're back here on Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Now, Dr. Knight, a lot of these preliminary figures you bring up, they definitely are concerning, and they show how, in the past few months, in this past year, how these statistics around youth mental health, they really have increased. Would you say, I know right now this is a lot of like preliminary data that's being collected, like it's hard to make these sort of predictions, but do you think this is going to be a really like long-term thing? If we look at this again in a few years, would you expect to see basically our current events reflected in these numbers, or would you anticipate there being more of a return to what we saw previously?
Yeah, that really good question. And it's something that I definitely have been putting a lot of thought into both, with my own hypotheses about what might happen, as well as how we can really document over time what's happening here. So maybe I'll get into what I sort of think might happen next. But what I'll say is what I really hope that we are able to do on my team with this focus survey is to extend this beyond 1 year. About half of the participants have agreed to be contacted regularly, so we could create a virtual cohort and follow them over time. So for instance, maybe 5 years out from now, and continue to document and understand how this moment in time plays out 5 years down the road. What we know in population health sciences in an area of study called life course theory, is that for young adults, they are at a period in their life course in which they're undergoing social economic transitions. So many, for instance, are joining the job market for the first time. Many are leaving their family home for the first time. They're starting education trajectories. And COVID-19 has really represented a profound disruption to how many of those transitions can and will occur, but not for everyone. I this is where my hypothesis comes in, is for those who are already economically or socially disadvantaged or experiencing some kind of oppression, I think they will likely experience the worst short, medium, and long-term outcomes associated with this pandemic. And that's concerning. Pandemics are what we would refer to in population health as inequity enhancing. So they exacerbate existing inequities. This is where I think projects like FOCUS are really needed so that we can document and identify where and how these inequities are occurring. So that public health interventions can meaningfully address the negative outcomes.
Definitely. Like I've heard a lot and I've read a lot about how in the past few months there's been a lot of news articles covering how the COVID-19 pandemic has been so-called like widening the wealth gap or the income gap. And it's really interesting to see how now, as you put it, this can also be applied to a lot of other like social or healthcare wise measures as well, where we're seeing a widening in that gap as well. And it's definitely good to see that there's interest that was being expressed by you into doing a long-term study onto this, because one of the key questions that like remains for me and many others is really seeing how does this pan out in 5 years, perhaps even in 10 years? Because as you mentioned, people in this age group in the 20s, they're going through a lot of these key developmental milestones. And I really feel that a lot of the things that are happening right now, they're definitely going to have impacts, whether they be positive or negative in some way, when you look down further in time.
Yeah. Yeah, this is really a moment in time where I think we need to be deploying our public health resources to one, understand who's experiencing this in worse off ways, in order to address it. And this is going to require what we refer to as upstream and downstream interventions. So the upstream ones that are really focusing on the conditions, the broader social and cultural economic conditions, as well as the acute needs of someone who's in distress, for example, whether it's economic distress or mental health distress. So,
One of those ways would likely be through accessing mental health services. Now, I'm assuming that they're probably very overwhelmed during this pandemic. Do you think that maybe difficulty to access mental health services for this reason is partly why some of those numbers are as scary as they are?
Around access to services, that is a hugely important piece. I saw a number, I'm trying to remember where I saw it the other day, where some mental health services were not seeing the, given that we're seeing these extreme disparities in numbers in mental health, in poor mental health outcomes, surprisingly, some of the mental health services, if I remember where I saw it, I'll bring it up. But it was, I think I was at a webinar and I wrote it down somewhere, but I'm sure there are other services though that are overwhelmed. And what I think we need to really think carefully around a multifaceted approach. So more and better services, of course, for mental health. One of the things I was involved with some research before COVID started, asking folks in a survey about do they want what we would refer to as suicide literacy. So understanding if someone may be experiencing thoughts of suicide, and then also some skills in terms of how to support your peer or loved one. And what we found there was most were very, very much wanting to improve their literacy in this area and their skills in helping. And almost all of them said they would prefer to learn those kinds of skills online. So, we can do those kinds of things in the current, under these current conditions if we have access to the internet. So, you know, it's about services. It's about you know, getting information out into our populations, and ultimately about some of these more upstream drivers, which tend to often be related to the social and economic conditions in which we're living. So, you know, for the folks who have lost an income due to COVID, we know that they will have more, the loss of income is associated with worse off mental health outcomes. So we need measures in place to help our, you know, our community who've lost their income, you know, to not just help them be able to buy food, but it's actually going to improve or could be associated with improvements in mental health. So very much a multifaceted approach. I'm a public health scientist, so that's tends to be how I view the world in terms of intervention. I have a measure here as well that I wanted to chat about that I think is very salient. And it's related to, you might remember this question, some questions around willingness to get a vaccine. And so we asked people in both Canada and France if they would be willing to get a vaccine. And in Canada, over 80% indicated of these young people in our survey indicated they would get it. And only 6% in this survey said they definitely will not get it. So that, you know, that's somewhat low, with the remaining wanting more information. And, you know, the good thing is more information about the different vaccines is on the way. You know, I know that these kinds of numbers can be kind of maybe not that helpful, because when we asked about vaccines, there were no approved vaccines at the time. But I think in some ways, if we look at these kinds of numbers as a moment in time, just to give us a clue about how the role young people might play in responding to population level vaccination programs, this, you know, to me, this is quite a promising piece. Of course, there will be more to come. And my hope is as this study goes on, we can really understand what are the factors associated with willingness and eagerness and acceptability to get vaccinated as the vaccine rolls out over the next year or so.
Great. And we'll be back to talk about vaccinations after just a few messages.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
To prevent the spread of coronavirus 2019, or COVID-19, social distancing and self-isolation measures have been recommended. What is social distancing? Social distancing includes, but is not limited to, discussing the possibility of working from home, avoiding visits to long-term care homes, retirement homes, supportive housing, hospices, and other congregate care settings unless the visit is absolutely essential, avoiding non-essential trips in the community, keeping the windows down if you have to go into the community for an essential trip via taxi or rideshare, limiting or canceling group gatherings, spending time outside and in settings where people can maintain 1 to 2 meters or 3 to 6 feet of distance from each other. These guidelines are not meant to say you must stay in your home. You can still go outside and take a walk, go to the park, or walk your dog. If you need groceries, go to the store. It is simply recommended that while outside, you make sure to avoid crowds and maintain a distance from those around you.
Stay away. Great. So we're back here on Research Review, CITR 101.9 FM. Now, on the topic of vaccinations, because that's interesting, definitely we're seeing a lot of developments right now with vaccines coming out right now. There was this study, some data that was released recently that I was looking at, and let me see who actually released it. It was a survey company, but I think it showed that overall, with a breakdown by age, it asked Canadians and Americans of different age groups. So there was like the 18 to 30 and then so on up until like the 65 plus. And what was interesting for me that it showed that older individuals were more likely to say that they would get a vaccine compared to younger ones. So what implications do you think that would have? And what is the reasoning behind that? Is there anything in the study so far that perhaps maybe hinting at why we're seeing data like this right now?
Yeah, so I think I saw the same study as you at one point. I don't know. Straight up answer, I don't know why we're seeing this. I wonder if it's partly that older populations really heavily needed vaccines to get out of previous, infectious disease problems. But I don't know. So I don't want to purport to be something I'm not. I'm not a vaccine scholar or expert in this area, but it is something that I think will be very interesting for those of us in public health to closely watch as we get these safety and efficacy results from the vaccination trials and as the vaccine programs scale up across the country. The effectiveness will depend on, large parts of our population to take up the vaccine. So it's a really important area of scholarship, and it's, more to come is basically, I guess, what I could say there. I don't know if you would have similar thoughts as to why we would be seeing those numbers. The numbers I saw, they weren't severe, but there was a difference.
Definitely. I mean, I feel like it's mostly just related to the whole, younger people viewing themselves as being, less at risk. But here, I actually pulled up the study right now. It was conducted by the firm Leger. And here it's interesting to see that it's one of the questions was that are vaccines dangerous? And in the 18 to 34 group, 74% answered no, but in the 55 plus group, 82% answered no. And I guess, what are your thoughts on that, Gurman?
Oh man, I have so many. I think partly it's due to the fact that young people sometimes think of themselves as invincible. Another thing would be social media. I think that's played a large part. Conspiracy theories are going around a lot these days, and I feel like social media is the biggest conductor of that, and you'd spend the largest amount of time on social media. And then there could also be just mistrust in medicine. I know I was watching CNN this morning, and I saw that Black and Hispanic populations were scoring very low on trust in the COVID-19 vaccine, whereas white and Asian populations were scoring super high. So I was wondering if that was just a historical mistrust in medicine, or that could be a reason.
This is such an important area. I have a colleague at UMass in the States, Devin Grace, and if you end up doing subsequent stories on vaccination, I definitely would recommend you talk to her. She's been studied quite extensively how young parents make decisions about vaccinating their infants, and now she's studying COVID-19 vaccination. So yeah, there's a lot going on here, and I think we've kind of hit it on the head that there's so many things that are social, that are related to our experiences and where we are in our life course, and it will be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, something we haven't touched on. We touched on a lot on mental health services. I was also curious about substance use services, whether that's increase in use or if it's similar to mental health services where some did, some didn't.
Yeah, so we're not seeing... So this is what I'll say is around that is we're seeing, so I've looked briefly at some of the substance use generally related, like self-reports of substance use, and it's a bit of a mixed bag, in fact. So we're seeing increases in alcohol consumption among some, but we're also seeing decreases among others. And the same, so there are higher increases reported, but... You know, many are also reporting consuming less than before COVID. So that's what I mean by a mixed bag. And so in terms of wanting to access services and related to their substance use related needs, I haven't seen those numbers exactly yet. I'm just trying to think of some of the qualitative data that we've gotten where... You know, it's definitely a tricky one. Are you aware of in BC, there's some risk mitigation guidelines because of the overlapping public health crises that there are? It's a public health order from the provincial health officer's office to extend some safe prescribing of substitution therapies to people who use drugs. And my understanding from a lot of the young people that myself and colleagues work with, this kind of program hasn't really reached a lot of them. A lot of them who could benefit from it don't know about the intervention. So I wonder how much engagement with sort of traditional substance use care services are occurring right now, but I don't really know right now. It's one of those areas where, you know, we still need to collect data, and here's the thing, like everyone, we are, like my team of researchers we can't go to the office, we can't go into the community to do what we're doing, so we're trying our hardest to be engaging with the young people who we were able to engage with before, including young people who are street engaged in the downtown south in Vancouver. And under the current conditions, we really have struggled with our ability to connect with a lot of them, to really understand what's going on in their lives. But, you know, I do have colleagues who have been closely working with some of these, you know, young people who, you know, might not have access to a phone or a computer or internet. And we're finding strategies to do that. COVID-19 is, you know, it's hard on everyone. It's especially hard on, you know, young people like this who are already experiencing extreme economic deprivation and poverty, and I think you know, substance use related harms are most likely, unfortunately and sadly, only worse for many of these young people. It plays out tragically in the overdose data, where we've seen overdose mortalities go up again with alongside COVID-19. So it's an area of ongoing investigation for my team, and it's a really important sort of focus area for us.
Yeah, I mean, something that concerned me is with the pandemic, a lot of the substances would probably be a lot more contaminated due to the closing of borders and more the use of illegal substances being put in substances. Do you think that could cause like a significant danger?
Yeah, and we know that is the case. So after the borders closed, the illicit drug supply became more toxic, and That was definitely one of the factors leading to the increases in overdose. So, you know, it's one more reason why a safer supply is needed to stop people from dying. And yeah, it's tragic. COVID-19 has, you know, we have multiple public health crises. So the overdose crisis was called in 2016 by, at the time, the provincial health officer, Perry Kendall. And it's only getting worse right now. So there's work to be done. Absolutely.
Yeah. The one last topic I wanted to talk about before we wrap things up was sexual health, because I know that was a significant part of the survey. How would you say that sexual health has changed during the pandemic?
Yeah, so there, you know, one of the, I actually have a call with a colleague who works on Get Checked Online, which is an online sexual health service that's available through the British Columbia Centre for Disease Control. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to check it out, but it's a way for people to get tested for sexually transmitted infections without going through a doctor. So you just go to Life Labs and get the specimens drawn. I'm really intrigued to see and hear more from them about how that service, how the sort of demands for the service has changed over COVID-19. You know, what we're seeing in terms of, let me just see what I've got. I didn't extract any numbers about sexual health related pieces, and we haven't really done any analyses on that yet. When we did look preliminarily, we were seeing, and this is probably bears out in that, you know, the number I already gave, most are adhering to public health guidelines, that they were reporting having less sex than before COVID-19. I think it's, you know, I've been watching just in the public discourse around the fatigue that is being reported, that especially young people are experiencing, and how that plays out in their romantic and sexual lives. And, you know, I don't know, that data is yet to be analyzed. Yeah, I don't have... That's not sexual health. Yeah, so forthcoming. Those data are forthcoming for analyses. I haven't seen a lot published academically. It's interesting. It's there's a lot of social media attention and attention in the media about how people are responding to COVID-19 in terms of sexual health. I do know that I saw some numbers around, so there's an HIV prevention, there's a prophylactic called pre-exposure prophylaxis, and I saw at one point, and the British Columbia provides it for those who meet a specific risk threshold, and a lot of gay and queer men meet that threshold, and so get access to PrEP through PharmaCare. And I saw at one point that this was earlier on in probably the spring or early summer, that PrEP prescriptions had gone way down. And so at that time we were thinking, well, that's probably likely because people aren't having sex, so they're not needing to take the prophylaxis or the prophylactic. But I haven't seen numbers to really support that hypothesis. The concern, of course, is that something like COVID-19 could relate and could result in, if folks don't have access to these kinds of medications, in increases in HIV, for instance, which we have not seen in BC for many, many years. We've seen declines in all populations. So, yeah, there, it's definitely a big area that we're going to continue working on. Yeah, my sincere hope is we do not see the HIV epidemic here in BC get exacerbated by what folks are experiencing from COVID-19.
Yeah, definitely. I would love to see the data in a few years to see how that turns out. So thank you so much for being on the show. This I definitely learned a lot today about youth mental health and the COVID-19 pandemic. It's definitely very enlightening.
Well, thank you for having me. This was great.
Definitely. And thank you, Dr. Knight, for joining us on the show today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM with Alirad and Gurman.